A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
A vegetable truck, a white van, and a villa, 250 meters from Hamas's own security headquarters. The man they pulled out wounded was Moeen El-Arabid, head of Hamas's internal security apparatus for the entire Gaza Strip, if you believe Israel's description. If you believe Hamas, he was something less. Either way, he was the man whose job was to stop exactly this from happening. Daniel's prompt lands on the raid, and the paradox it exposes. Who's El-Arabid? What does head of internal security apparatus actually mean in practice? And how do groups like Hamas run counterintelligence and suppress dissent? Why do these systems keep failing despite being brutal? And can you call them successful at all for maintaining internal culture? There's a tension here. The machine works until it doesn't. And when it doesn't, it fails in the most spectacular way possible. So let's start with what we actually know about El-Arabid, which turns out to be surprisingly little and surprisingly contested.
The ambiguity is the first thing worth sitting with. Israel describes him as one of Hamas's most senior leaders, comparable to the Sinwar brothers, responsible for hiding hostages, hiding senior figures, rebuilding the organization's capabilities. A Palestinian security source told Al Jazeera he was a more junior officer. Hamas sources told Ashark al-Awsat he was not merely an ordinary officer, but denied he was at the very top tier and denied any role with hostages. Nobody agrees on who this man actually was.
Which is itself a feature of how these organizations work. The opaqueness isn't a bug. It's the point.
And the operation details are extraordinary. Shin Bet tracked him for weeks, mapped his daily routine, planned the raid over several months. They used disguised vehicles, a white van, and a vegetable truck. They stormed the villa. A firefight erupted. His two sons opened fire. Two bodyguards opened fire. His wife was shot in the head at close range and killed. The sons and bodyguards were seriously wounded. El-Arabid himself was shot and wounded before capture. The Israeli Air Force struck targets to cover the withdrawal, and they destroyed a vehicle left in the area days earlier so no equipment fell into Hamas hands.
Netanyahu's line was, "Yesterday we took Hamas's Shin Bet chief. We'll probably learn a few things." And Israeli security sources told Channel 12 the raid was intended not only for intelligence, but to make senior Hamas leaders feel hunted, even during a period of relative calm.
Because the Shin Bet is Israel's internal security service. Counter-terrorism, counter-espionage, protecting state secrets. Netanyahu is saying El-Arabid was the man who ran Hamas's version of that. Counterintelligence, hunting collaborators, suppressing dissent. The man who hunted collaborators was himself hunted, tracked for weeks, raided in his own home, captured alive, 250 meters from his own headquarters.
250 meters. That's not a failure of intelligence at the margins. That's a failure at the core.
And to understand how that failure happened, we need to understand the apparatus he ran and where it came from.
Which starts earlier than most people realize.
1986. Al-Majd is founded, a year before Hamas itself exists. Sheikh Ahmad Yassin establishes it specifically to uncover Israeli collaborators. From day one, the counterintelligence mission predates the political movement. The security apparatus isn't an afterthought bolted onto Hamas. It's the foundation.
And the methods were what you'd expect. Torture against suspects and their relatives. The reputation was built quickly and deliberately.
Yahya Sinwar began his career in Al-Majd in the mid-1980s. His initial focus was enforcing moral discipline, rooting out homosexuality, before expanding into counterintelligence and hunting collaborators. He was arrested by Israel in 1989 for killing alleged collaborators. The apparatus he helped build is the same one that failed to protect El-Arabid 40 years later.
So the man who institutionalized paranoia and brutality as tools of internal control. His system ultimately couldn't protect its own security chief from the very penetration it was designed to prevent.
Let me trace the evolution, because it matters for understanding why the failure is structural, not just operational. After Hamas took full control of Gaza in 2007, Al-Majd was renamed the Internal Security Force and established units throughout the Strip. But it's actually three parallel bodies. The General Security Service. That's the political arm, focused on stifling dissent. Military Intelligence, focused on Israel. And the Internal Security Service, the Interior Ministry arm. The General Security Service answered directly to Sinwar.
Three separate organizations, overlapping mandates, competing for relevance. That's not a security architecture designed for efficiency. That's an architecture designed to ensure no single person can consolidate enough power to become a threat to the top.
And yet the General Security Service was extraordinarily capable at what it did. Before the 2023 war, it employed 856 people, monthly budget of $120,000. It kept files on at least 10,000 Palestinians. Tracking political activity, social media posts, protests, even romantic relationships outside marriage. Over 160 employees were paid specifically to spread propaganda and launch online attacks against opponents.
10,000 files in a population of roughly 2 million. That's one in every 200 people with a dossier. The Stasi comparison writes itself.
That comparison came from Michael Milstein, a former Israeli military intelligence officer. He said, and I'm quoting, "This General Security Service is just like the Stasi of East Germany. You always have an eye on the street."
But the Stasi had a state behind it. Hamas is running an East German-level surveillance apparatus while under siege, while fighting an act of war, while its leadership is being systematically killed or captured. The strain on that system has to be immense.
And the informant network is the part that's hardest to sustain under those conditions. Palestinians report their own neighbors. Journalists are surveilled. Social media criticism is censored. The New York Times investigation found that, quoting again, "Palestinians in Gaza live in fear and hesitate to express dissent." Mekaymar Abusada, a Gaza-born political scientist, said, "There are a lot of people practicing self-censorship. They just don't want problems with the Hamas government."
Which is the apparatus working as designed? But here's where the design starts eating itself. The journalist Ihab Vasfus told The Times, "If you're not with them, you become an atheist, an infidel, and a sinner. That level of repression doesn't just silence dissent, it creates enemies. And enemies are recruitment opportunities for the other side."
This is the fundamental contradiction, and it's worth pausing on. The brutality that maintains control also generates the disaffection that Israel exploits to recruit informants. Every person whose family member was tortured, every journalist who was silenced, every neighbor who was reported by another neighbor. They don't stop existing. They remember, and some percentage of them become usable.
So the apparatus is simultaneously succeeding at internal control and manufacturing its own vulnerabilities.
And Hamas knows this. That's why they've invested so heavily in double agent operations. The Flamer study, Netanel Flamer's 2022 paper in the International Journal of Intelligence and Counterintelligence, documented that the Internal Security Force has run sophisticated double-agent operations against the Shin Bet lasting up to 2 years. That's orders of magnitude longer than Al-Majd operations, which lasted days or weeks.
2 years. Running an asset inside Israeli intelligence for 2 years while preventing them from realizing they've been turned. That's not the work of a clumsy, purely brutal organization. That's sophisticated tradecraft.
And those operations gave Hamas access to details about Shin Bet recruitment methods, agent handling, and communication systems. They used that to bust agent networks. So the apparatus isn't just repressing the population. It's actively fighting an intelligence war against a far more powerful adversary and winning rounds.
The case of Mahmoud Ishtiwi is where the two functions, internal discipline and counterintelligence, collapse into each other. Tell me about him.
Ishtiwi was a respected Al-Qassam battalion commander, senior insider. And in 2016, he was arrested on charges of behavioral and moral violations. That's the euphemism for homosexuality. He was held in secret detention, beaten for 20 hours at a time, suspended by limbs, whipped, sleep-deprived, tortured for over a year, then executed. His family appealed to Ismail Haniyeh and Mohammed Deif. Both ignored them.
a battalion commander. Not a foot soldier, not a low-level operative. Someone with operational knowledge, with networks, with loyalty that had been tested, and the apparatus reached inside its own senior ranks and destroyed him.
Which sends a message to everyone else in the organization, no one is safe. Not even the people who've proven themselves in combat. Not even the people who've been loyal for years. If the apparatus decides you're a threat, whether for moral reasons, or because someone suspects you of collaboration, or because you've made an enemy of the wrong person, there's no protection, there's no appeal, there's no due process.
And that message works. It keeps people in line. But it also means that when the apparatus does have a real penetration problem, the people who might know about it are terrified to report it. Because reporting a suspicion means drawing attention to yourself. And attention from the internal security apparatus is never safe.
So the apparatus is sophisticated, brutal, and deeply embedded. But if it's so effective, if it's running two-year double-agent operations and crushing dissent and keeping files on 10,000 people, how did the man in charge end up captured 250 meters from his own headquarters?
That's the question the episode turns on.
Let me give you the most immediate answer first. Israel's penetration of Hamas is extensive. Haaretz noted that Al-Arabid's interrogation could reveal what Hamas knows about Israel's current agent network in Gaza, the implication being that Israel operates significant human intelligence inside the organization. The Shin Bet's own internal investigation, published March 2025, admitted it failed in its mission to prevent the October 7th attack. But since then, Israel has killed or captured successive layers of Hamas leadership. Mohammed Dababish, head of the General Security Service, was killed in November 2023, now Al-Arabid. The penetration is deep and ongoing.
The October 7th attack demonstrated a massive Israeli intelligence failure, but it was tactical and temporary. The structural advantage remains with Israel, and the Al-Arabid raid is the proof.
Non-state actors like Hamas face an asymmetric intelligence war that they can't win in the long run. Israel's technological and human intelligence resources are exponentially larger. Signals intelligence, satellite imagery, cyber capabilities, informant networks built over decades. The longer the conflict continues, the more penetration points Israel can develop. Double agent operations offer what the Flamer study called achievements of the greatest impact using the most efficient means, despite resource poverty, but they're tactical wins in a strategic losing battle.
There's something else, though. The structural disadvantage isn't just about resources. It's about what the apparatus does to its own population. We talked about the contradiction. Brutality creates enemies, but it also creates something more subtle. It creates a population that's practiced at deception.
Say more about that.
If you live under a system where expressing dissent gets you a file opened, where your neighbors might report you, where social media posts are tracked, you learn to lie. You learn to perform loyalty. You learn to say the right things in public and keep your real thoughts private. That's survival. But it also means the security apparatus is constantly reading a population that's deliberately obscuring its true beliefs. The signal-to-noise ratio gets worse and worse. Everyone looks like a loyalist because everyone has to look like a loyalist. The people who actually are disaffected are hiding in the same performance as everyone else.
Which makes the vetting problem nearly impossible. When everyone is performing loyalty, how do you identify the real threats? You can't torture everyone. You can't open files on everyone. So you rely on the informant network, which is itself full of people settling personal scores, reporting neighbors they don't like, fabricating accusations to curry favor. The apparatus drowns in noise.
And Israel's intelligence services have been doing this long enough to know exactly how to exploit that noise. They don't need to recruit someone who openly hates Hamas. They need to find someone who's already hiding their disaffection, already performing loyalty, already invisible to the apparatus, and give them a reason to act.
The Al-Arabid raid is the case study. Someone, somewhere, provided the intelligence that let Shin Bet track him for weeks. Someone knew his routine, his location, his security arrangements. That someone was inside the performance, and the apparatus didn't see them.
We've established that the apparatus fails at its primary mission, preventing penetration. But Daniel's prompt asks a second question. To what extent can it be considered successful at maintaining internal culture?
The answer is uncomfortable. It's been highly successful at that. The We Want to Live protests in 2023, criticizing power shortages and cost of living, were crushed. Self-censorship is widespread. The New York Times investigation found that Palestinians in Gaza hesitate to express dissent even in private conversations. The apparatus has created a culture of fear that works.
Despite losing successive leaders, Dababish killed, now al-Arabid captured. The apparatus continues to function. Hamas sources told Ashark al-Azat, the organization is actively investigating the raid and taking steps to limit intelligence damage. The Jerusalem Post noted that, while severely weakened, Hamas remains in control. The machine keeps running even as its leadership is decapitated.
This is the paradox. The apparatus fails at its primary mission, preventing penetration by the enemy, but succeeds at its secondary mission, maintaining internal control and organizational cohesion. And the question is whether that's sustainable.
I think the answer is that it's sustainable right up until it isn't. These systems don't degrade gradually. They hold and hold and hold, and then they break. And when they break fast, because the very brutality that made them effective also made them brittle. There's no resilience in a system built on fear. No one steps forward to save it when it starts to crumble. They step back.
The October 7th attack cuts both ways here. It demonstrated that Hamas could maintain operational security for a massive, complex attack, which means the internal security apparatus was effective enough to prevent leaks. But it also showed that the apparatus couldn't prevent Israel from eventually learning operational details, identifying leadership, and systematically dismantling the organization. The Shin Bet's failure was tactical and temporary. The structural advantage, the ability to penetrate, to track, to capture, remains with Israel.
The raid was designed to demonstrate exactly that. Israeli sources told Channel 12 the goal was to make senior Hamas leaders feel hunted even during relative calm. It's psychological warfare, as much as intelligence gathering. The message is, we can reach you anywhere. We can track you for weeks. We can drive a vegetable truck into your neighborhood and pull you out of your home. And there's nothing your internal security apparatus can do to stop us.
The vegetable truck isn't the interesting part.
Go on.
I spent 6 months in a windowless room in 2002 reading debriefs from turned informants. Private security consultancy, advising a government in the region, not Israel, not the Palestinians, a third party that had to deal with both. And the thing I learned, the only thing that mattered, is that every internal security apparatus has a blind spot for the person who's been there longest. You're talking about the Stasi comparisons and the brutality and the double agents. But the real problem is institutional memory. Al-Majd was founded in 1986. That's 40 years. 40 years of the same families, the same networks, the same grudges. When you've been hunting collaborators that long, you start to trust the people you've always trusted. And that's exactly who gets turned. The longest double agent operations last 2 years. You said that. Do you know why 2 years? It's not because the tradecraft is good. It's because after 2 years, the handler starts to believe the asset is loyal. The handler has invested 2 years in this person. They've met. They've built rapport. The asset has delivered real intelligence, real enough to be useful, not so real that it hurts. And at some point, the handler stops seeing the asset as an asset and starts seeing them as a colleague. That's not a tactical failure. That's a human one.
The handler's own psychology becomes the vulnerability.
Every time. The most effective informants we found, and I read hundreds of these debriefs, were never the ones who were tortured or blackmailed. They were the ones who believed they were doing the right thing. Hamas's apparatus creates so many enemies that it's drowning in potential assets. The problem isn't finding people who hate them. The problem is vetting the ones who don't.
The apparatus is generating its own threat pool faster than it can screen it.
The person who's been inside longest knows exactly how the screening works. They helped build it. They know what the investigators look for, what questions they ask, what answers are safe. They've been performing loyalty for 20 years. The apparatus can't see them because the apparatus is them. The villa was 250 meters from headquarters. Someone knew he was there. Someone knew when the security rotation changed. Someone knew which vehicles wouldn't draw attention. That someone wasn't a new recruit who got sloppy. That someone had been there long enough to know everything.
The institutional blind spot. You trust the people who built the system because if you can't trust them, the system doesn't work. But they're the ones with the access, the knowledge, and the grudges.
I had a colleague who used to say, "The only person you can't turn is the one who's already turned himself. Everyone else is available."
That institutional blind spot Hilbert's describing, it's worth sitting with as we wrap up, because it reframes the whole question of success and failure.
The internal security apparatus of a totalitarian terrorist group is a machine that works exactly as designed, until it doesn't. It crushes dissent, it enforces ideological conformity, it maintains organizational cohesion through leadership decapitation. It succeeds at all of that. But the very features that make it succeed, the brutality, the paranoia, the institutional memory that calcifies into trust in the wrong people, are the features that make it fail. And when it fails spectacularly, because there's no resilience in a system built on fear.
The one thing I'll take from this, success and failure aren't opposites here. They're two sides of the same coin. The apparatus fails at its primary mission because of how it succeeds at its secondary one. You can't have the internal control without generating the enemies. You can't have the institutional memory without creating the blind spots. The machine contains its own destruction.
What will Al Arabid's interrogation yield? That's the open question. Israeli security officials believe it could be an intelligence trove, potentially revealing what Hamas knows about Israel's current agent network in Gaza. If that network is as extensive as Haaretz implies, Al Arabid might be the person who can map it. And if he does, the apparatus loses its last defensive layer.
The raid was designed to make senior Hamas leaders feel hunted, even during calm. If the apparatus can't protect its own security chief 250 meters from headquarters, what does that mean for Hamas's long-term governance of Gaza? The structural disadvantage isn't going away. The penetration will deepen. The question isn't whether the apparatus will fail again. It's how many more times it can fail before the cohesion breaks entirely.
Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping us honest and for the windowless room in 2002.
This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com or email us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.